Good evening. It is Tuesday, February 15th, 2022 at 5:30. Welcome to the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all. Roll call of members.
Deborah Dawson. Deborah Dawson.
Yes, here.
Henry Granison.
Present.
Rich John.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Greg Mezzi.
Here.
Veronica Piller.
Here.
Lee Shurtleff.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Travis Brooks. Randy Brown.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
We have 13 members present.
Thank you very much. And we are going to start off by welcoming our Poet Laureate, Christine Catano. She was our Poet Laureate last year, and we are happy to have her join us this afternoon for a wonderful reading.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone's doing all right. So thank you for inviting me to your meeting. Seeing that it is the day after Valentine's Day, so I think still Valentine's week, I've picked two poems to read today. The first poem I'll read is by the poet Gwendolyn Brooks, who I'm teaching right now in my class at Ithaca College. And this is one of my favorite poems by her. And it's called When You Have Forgotten Sunday, The Love Story. When you have forgotten Sunday, and when you have forgotten the bright bedclothes on a Wednesday and a Saturday, and most especially when you have forgotten Sunday, when you have forgotten Sunday halves in bed, or me sitting on the front room radiator in the limping afternoon, looking off down the long street to nowhere, hugged by my plain old wrapper of no expectation and nothing I have to do and I'm happy why and if Monday never had to come. When you have forgotten that, I say, and how you swore if somebody beeped the bell and how my heart played hopscotch if the telephone rang and how we finally went into Sunday dinner. That is to say, went across the front room floor to the ink-spotted table in the southwest corner to Sunday dinner, which was always chicken and noodles, or chicken and rice, and salad, and rye bread, and tea, and chocolate chip cookies. I'd say, when you have forgotten that, when you have forgotten my little presentiment that the war would be over before they got to you, and how we finally undressed and whipped out the light and flowed into bed and lay loose-limbed for a moment in the weekend bright bedclothes, then gently folded into each other. When you have, I say, forgotten all that, then you may tell, then I may believe you have forgotten me well. That's a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, published in 1945. And the second poem I'll read is a contemporary poem by my friend, the poet James Cruz. And he shared this poem for Valentine's Day. And he lives in Vermont, but it feels like a very Ithaca poem as well. So it's called Waiting for Coffee. I could have lived in that moment forever, standing in line at the crowded cafe, early risers huddled at their tables with the burnt toast scent of roasting coffee wafting in the air around us. When my husband turned to face me, opened his arms in a wide bear hug, and held me like that for a single beat, heart to heart pulsing beneath our coats and several layers of flannel, like we were the only two men in the universe. Then it was over, and I stared up at burlap sacks of beans stacked on the counter, the ponytailed barista pulling shots like nothing had happened, though I was glowing when we stepped forward to order, still held in the field of that sudden embrace. And that one is by my team, James. Thank you all for having me, and have a wonderful meeting, and keep poetry and love in your lives.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we would like to continue to invite you to our legislature meetings. It's always nice to have you visit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to make an announcement of executive session this evening. We have four topics: litigation, real estate negotiations, contract negotiations, and personnel matter about a particular person. Now, let's open it up for privilege of the floor for the public. And
we had one member sign up to speak, Zachary Wynn.
Okay, welcome, Zach.
Good evening. Am I the one set to speak?
You are the one speaker.
Thank you. My name is Zachary Wynn. I'd like to inquire about the status of the county quarterly opioid report. It is my understanding that the last one that was issued was from July of 2021. It is almost the second quarter of 2022. And where are those reports? I would also like to ask, in a recent interview on WHCU, Reimagining Public Safety Working Group member Tom Conzella said that members of the working group have been asked to not speak publicly about the process. And I'd like to ask Travis Brooks, who is also on the committee, to explain the lack of transparency in the police reimagination process. Thank you very much, and I yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Are there any other comments that we received?
No.
Thank you. Next, we have municipal officials, and I see Patrick is here from the City of Ithaca. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, all. Sorry, I have very terrible lighting. No updates since George and I visited you all about 2 weeks ago. I'm more than happy to answer any questions on behalf of the city. We'll be having our planning and economic development committee meeting on Wednesday, and our city administration committee meeting the week after that. But the only update we have is we are planning to receive the Reimagining Public Safety report at our Wednesday meeting in March. So, we're happy to answer any questions, but nothing on our end to report back.
Thank you. Any questions? Randy Brown?
Hey, Patrick. I've got a question. Is there any reason the snow isn't being removed around here like it should be? I mean, the parking areas, the snow is not being cleared, so it's really tough to park. And when you get out of a car, it's quite slippery. And us old people worry about falling down. I noticed a lot of crosswalks, too, work, so I just wanted to share that with you. It seemed like a concern for people. So,
sure, I can definitely sort of forward that through. I know DPW, our Department of Public Works, is clearing as much as they can, as quickly as they can. I know they're a little short-staffed right now, and they've been trying to follow the schedule as best they can, but I'm more than happy to send that along to them.
Any other questions or comments for Patrick? Dan Klein?
Yeah, Patrick, you may not be able to answer this moment, but I'm interested in the redistricting process, and I heard the city had started it, but I just wanted to see if it's moving along pretty well there or anything else you can report. Thank you.
Sure. So I know the city redistricting committee, they have been meeting and holding public hearings for the county as well. I know Hank Dulea has been doing a great job in having those hearings. The most recent one, I believe, was last Tuesday, specifically for college students within the city of Ithaca. But I know they have at least one more meeting, I believe, and then they will present recommendations to council in April.
Any other questions for Patrick? Okay, I see none. Thank you, Patrick, for joining us. Do we have any other municipal officials? I don't see any. Okay, moving on to privilege of the floor for legislators. Any announcements or comments from our legislators? Come on, Mike. Okay, there we go. Lee Shurtleff.
Something I want to mention tonight, having to do with the volunteer fire service. On January 20th in Monticello in Sullivan County, the fire occurred, and the fire service is mourning the loss of an assistant chief from the Forest Burg Fire Department, William Steinberg, Billy Steinberg. And he came from a community of 800 people, Forest Burg, and represented a department, volunteer department, not unlike many of those that protect us here in Tompkins County. Why I bring this up? Turns out the fire has been ruled as an arson, and an individual has been arrested. And that individual charged is believed to be a serial arsonist who had been arrested two times previously in recent months under the charge of arson. In a discussion the other day with Matt Van Houten, I asked about what third and fourth degree arson, how that's not a felony, and it's because the fire originates in an unoccupied structure, which is what this was. But ultimately, a volunteer died, and this individual had been released without bail on a nonviolent felony. And I bring that up just from the standpoint that as we reimagine public safety at all levels of government, I hope that we collectively, those who legislate, will go back and evaluate the decisions that are made, recalibrate, and attempt to strike the balance of public safety that's necessary in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee, for sharing. Ann Corman?
Thank you. In honor of Black History Month, I just wanted to mention that in the Olympics, if people are watching that, Erin Jackson became the first Black woman to win individual gold at the Winter Olympics, and the first, and of course, the first Black woman to win a speed skating medal, and she won in the 500 meters. And so I just wanted to put that out there and say her name there, and wanted to encourage people of all races to participate in sports and in your community and at every level. So thank you to her for representing the USA and Black History Month. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Randy Brown?
I'd just like to say that the new legislatures have been visiting with various departments over the last few weeks. It's been very helpful for us. Veronica's pillar's been setting up all the schedules, and we've got a couple more this week, I think, and next week. And it's very good to meet the people that are doing all the work. And I just wanted to thank you guys for advising that.
That's great. Thank you, Randy. Thank you, Veronica. I know that whenever the five of us joined, Amanda was our organizer, and it was very eye-opening to see all of the tasks that the county does and to meet the great people that are working. Any other questions or comments? Mike Lane?
A couple of years ago, we began and completed a study of a portion of our federal highway, our lifeline in Tompkins County, which is Route 13 from the village of Dryden to the village of Lansing. When we did that, The idea was, let's do some studying of the dangerous intersections, some of the problems with that road, so that when there was money available, we could work with New York State. Of course, it's New York State's highway, not ours. But we could work with them to try to get the grant funding to do projects, for example, at Lower Creek Road or Hanshaw Road, pedestrian crossings and at Warren, those kinds of things. And now that we have an infrastructure bill at the federal level, and this is a federal highway, I think it's time to not sit back on our laurels with the completion of that study, but to push forward to see if we can't work together with New York State to obtain some federal funding to do some of those projects that we thought would be a good thing for Route 13 and improve the safety for our residents there. It was brought to my mind clearly one day last week when I came down very early in the morning, and it was a very cold morning, very heavy traffic. Traffic was backed up toward Dryden from, well, as far back as, if you know where the veterinary hospital is, the new one. What had happened was there was a chain reaction collision in the very cold weather. I couldn't tell for sure, but it looked to me like there was at least 6, 7, 8 cars that probably had collided. I don't think it was a terribly bad collision because they were going fairly slowly. But it just kind of tells us the kinds of things that can happen, particularly in that overlap area, which is Route 13 and Route 366. That section continues to need to be looked at. It probably needs a center lane added. It probably needs better signalization, better signage, and we need other things that happen. They just put a new set of blinking yellow red lights at Minia Road and Etna Road, and that is a nice safety improvement that's there. Of course, some people were killed at that intersection here a couple of years ago. I won't speak any more, but I just want to keep that on the forefront. That's an important project that we now have an opportunity to ask for federal funds for.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comments from legislators? Okay, I see none. Thank you all. I have a pretty quick chair's report this evening. I'm glad that you brought up the Route 13 conversation, Mike. Interestingly enough, today Sheriff Osborne and I went to Binghamton and were part of a recruiting presentation for the state police. Initially, we thought we would go and try and pick up some of their strategies. And it was interesting because the first thing that the commissioner stated was the one thing that we value the most in our recruiting is diversity and inclusion. And throughout his speech, he talked about reimagining and refocusing efforts on recruiting to recruiting people that are diverse and having more inclusion in law enforcement. And, of course, Derek and I were very shocked because this was happening in Broome County. The main focus was actually having people that are policing that look like their communities. He brought forth how 15% of our population in New York State is African American. However, only 4% of those that are state troopers are African American. He also mentioned Latino, 15%, and how at this point only 3% is Latino. They said that right now they are struggling to get applicants that are applying to be New York State troopers. Obviously, this tends to be a law enforcement issue, and many of us are struggling for to receive qualified applicants. They are going to change the terms which people can apply for these positions. They used to be once every 4 years. They're moving it to 2 years. They are also going to start opening up some of the past guidelines that they've had as far as records, and many people have not been able to apply due to marijuana usage. Since those records are being expunged, that opens up a handful of applicants. People between the ages of 20 and 30 are welcome to apply on their website. And some of the great things that they talked about were the fact that they have great retirement, work 20 years, and you can retire with a full pension. Also, obviously, great health benefits. The one thing that I was the most impressed with was the focus in that recruiting presentation was 100% on the equity, diversity, and inclusion. So I really like to hear that. They had pastors from religious organizations. They had superintendents. They had teachers, professors, everyone in the community from Broome, leaders throughout the community. And I think it was just a very powerful message for them to get everyone in the room and ask all of us to advocate for finding people in our communities that might be interested in this work. I ended up sitting next to the commissioner of DOT, who is stationed out of Syracuse, and whenever we spoke about our Route 13 study, he said that one thing they were looking at right now with the addition of Carpenter Park and what they see will be some more increased traffic patterns is the conversation is going towards making Buffalo a one-way whenever it gets to Meadow and Fulton. So he thinks that will help the traffic patterns. So we will see. That is my chair's report. Are there any questions? I did bring up Mike Sigler's idea of the bridge across Route 13, and that was not on his list of projects. So I'm sorry.
I find that to be unfortunate, Sean.
I do too. I do too. Yep.
I'm going to make that happen. You know that. So.
Hey, here's hoping. Yep. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Special topical presentation and or discussion, we do not have any. Let's hear from our interim county administrator, Lisa Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a brief update tonight, and then we have a COVID update. So for my brief update, I wanted to make you all aware that the closing occurred on the 300 and 308 North Tioga Street properties last Friday and yesterday, respectively. So the county is now the owner of those two properties right down the street. We now have six-month lease agreements in place for the current tenants of those buildings, and we're working with our finance and facilities departments on the finer points of changing over the utilities and setting up accounts for the lease payments that will be coming back to the county. So I'm happy to report that that transaction has taken place smoothly. And I also wanted to remind the legislature and make our new legislators aware that the sale of the county-owned parcel on Sears Street to Ithaca Neighborhood Housing was contingent on the closing of the 300 and 308 North Tioga Street properties. So now that that closing has taken place, we'll be notifying INHS that they can proceed with the city's subdivision approval process, and that will include a deed restriction requiring that the development of that property will be limited to affordable for sale housing units through the Community Housing Trust Fund. So glad to report on these items, and I'm happy to take any questions on them before we move to the COVID report.
Are there any questions for Lisa Holmes? I see none. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. And then we have Amy Hendricks, Deputy County Administrator, and Frank Cooper, our Public Health Director, for the COVID update.
Right. Well, thank you all. I'm going to go ahead and provide some overview. We're going to follow the same format as last time. So we don't have a presentation for you, though our talking points will be added to the ongoing presentation since the beginning of all of these presentations in March or April of 2020. So since we last met, our hospitalizations have declined some. We are currently at 12 hospitalizations. Unfortunately, we have had another community member pass away due to COVID, so we're continuing to watch the severity of disease, but we are seeing that the numbers of positive cases are, while we're still seeing positivity, things are improving here. Also, since we last met, the governor had announced that they will not be extending the mask mandate, and we had released information on our advisory, which Frank will talk a little bit more on. The executive order about remote meetings and the continuation of other executive orders has been reissued and extended till March 14th. There were some changes within that executive order, and that just occurred yesterday, so it's going month to month at this point. Remote meetings are continuing at least through March 14th. There is the ability to do that. The other big thing I think that has occurred since we last met is we had ordered KN95 masks. So we had 250,000 KN95 masks that we've been distributing to our community through a lot of different venues. A lot of our community partners, our municipal offices, nonprofit agencies, food pantries. Frank, Mike Stightley, Jay Franklin, Dominic, Lisa, I think Jeff Dunn and I went to the Commons on Thursday and handed them out to passersby there. So we've had a lot of different efforts to do that as well. So they continue to go out, and we're also distributing self-test kits, and we'll be distributing more of those this week. We are also looking at securing some children's KN95 masks. So there are different sizes, and we're going to get some of those as well to distribute to the community. I think those are the major updates that I have. We're continuing to provide information about what is happening. I'm going to turn it over to Frank to talk about any of the other updates that he may have tonight.
Thanks, Amy. I just quickly wanted to touch on the mask mandate. I think everyone's acutely aware that the governor lifted the mandate in New York State, except for some identified locations, healthcare, school settings, and public transportation included. And then we subsequently reemphasized the advisory for mask wearing that we've had in place since before the governor's mandate. So when we announced that, it was really just a reaffirmation of what was in place before. And we got a lot of questions about that from both directions. Should we be doing this, and why haven't we done it sooner? And I think, you know, what I wanted to point out, the mandate was not a local mandate. It was established by the governor. Here locally, we've been following the CDC guidance on masking since the onset, and their guidance is that if you're in a substantial or high transmission area, which we currently are, that masks are recommended for indoor settings. And that's really what we've been following and asking people to follow outside of the governor's mandate. So there is not a mandate. It's not something that we're enforcing, but it is absolutely something that we are recommending for our community. The governor lifting the mandate should not be interpreted to mean that masks don't work. Or that there's no risk to COVID anymore. The mandate was a tool that she chose to use and a tool that she chose to stop using. And her timing associated with that is really, you know, up to her. But from our perspective, the science, I know that word has become, you know, taboo now, but it hasn't changed. Masks are not perfect. We've never said they are perfect, but in a layered approach, they will help to limit the spread of disease. And while we still have it here active in our community, we are trying to protect those that are most vulnerable, including our seniors and those that are immunocompromised. And as Amy pointed out, we still have people in the hospital, and unfortunately, we still have people dying from COVID. So we are recommending and ask that our community, until our numbers get low enough, continue to wear a mask indoors. Then the next question we get is, well, when is this going to end, or when will the advisory go away? There are pretty clear metrics in place and have been for quite some time on the substantial transmission and high transmission levels on the CDC's scale. What I want to point out is that the advisory is not based off of high transmission, but rather the substantial transmission, which is measured at 50 cases per 100,000 residents on the seven-day rolling average. So that's the number that we're looking to achieve, at which point we would then lift the local advisory on masking. There is a positivity rate that the CDC also uses, and they go by the highest of the two as far as their recommendation goes. Our positivity rate is lower than most places, as it has been throughout, in large part because of the significant amount of testing that the county has sponsored, as well as our higher education institutions. So there is a metrics in place, and we'll be obviously following that and reporting on it. And as soon as we're comfortable that we've reached and sustained those levels, then at that point we will lift the advisory. That's all I had.
Thank you, Frank. Are there any questions for Frank or Amy? Okay, I have Deb Dawson and then Randy Brown.
Just a quick question, Frank. I want to be sure I understand. When we get to that substantial transmission level, is that when the mask advisory will be lifted, or is that where we are now?
No, we are at high transmission. There's a level below high called substantial. Technically, we need to be in moderate transmission to lift the advisory, and that is the less than 50 cases per 100,000.
Thank you.
Randy Brown.
Thank you. Frank, I know you meet with the school districts quite often and talk to the superintendents and whatnot. If we will get below that 50 number, how are the schools deciding what they're going to do? I mean, are they going by your recommendation, or how are you guys feeling about that?
So the school districts are under a mandate from the state to mask the children, and so that will ultimately be a governor's decision. Depending on where our case levels are, at the point that the governor lifts the mandate on the schools, we would only have a recommendation for school districts. It would not be a mandate. So if we are under that 50 number, which if we get below that number, I'd expect the governor would have already lifted the mandate. But if she lifts the mandate and we are not yet under that number, it would be a recommendation, as it is now, for anyone that's indoors from 2 years and up that's able to wear a mask, continue to wear a mask while indoors. But it would not be a mandate. If the districts chose to have their own mandate, that would be up to the superintendents and their school boards.
Also, looking at your website, which has a lot of information that I actually, it's overwhelming, as I mentioned before, and I looked at it again today. But I did look under the medical doctor's report, and it talked about things that you can do. It talked about hydrochloroquine, if I said that correctly. But the discussion was dated well over a year ago. And it'd be nice to see an update on that as to what people should be doing. Understand they should go to their doctor and those kinds of things. But as I mentioned last time, it'd be good to let people know what's coming on the horizon. There's some hope down the way, as opposed to, what I read, which was good, but not current.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that for viruses in general, treatments are not, there are not a lot of treatments. There is a medicine on the market now, an antiviral that has been approved for COVID. It is still limited in its supply. I believe there's only one pharmacy that has a small supply in town. and our local doctors are able to prescribe it, you know, based on the current criteria for accessing it. But other than that, the treatments have been, the monoclonal antibodies are not as effective or are not effective for Omicron. And so the CDC has, the FDA has removed EUA authorization for those. So really everything else is off-label use of other drugs. And that really is between an individual and their healthcare provider, and their willingness to write prescriptions and such for those types of medications. But there are antivirals on the horizon, and I agree with you. We want to give folks as much hope as possible. And those really will be a game changer when they're more readily available and there's multiple versions on the market.
Thank you.
Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Amy and Frank, for this update. I just had one quick clarification question. I think it was Amy that mentioned that the open meetings law was through, and the executive, which is part of the executive order, is through March 14th. I'm online, and so I'm seeing it's through March 16th, unless I'm seeing some part of that that.
I had March 14th in my notes, Ann, but we will double check it and confirm what that extension goes through.
Okay. I believe it's with the executive order with the state of emergency, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm seeing it through March 16th, but okay. If we could have clarification on that. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem.
Dan Klein.
Yeah, thank you. Some of us were in a meeting earlier today with Rod Howe, the town supervisor of the town of Ithaca, and he mentioned he just praised Tompkins County for its leadership throughout this whole COVID journey we've been taking. So I just wanted to pass that along to a larger audience so that people can hear it. Thank you to the health department, to county administration, to all our employees that have really, done an outstanding job in a very difficult time. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Frank, I just had a question in regards to vaccine. And if people need a vaccine or need a booster, can you tell us what the process would be?
Yeah, we are finishing up some second dose clinics for children, and we're doing some small booster clinics for some community partners this week. But that'll be really rounding out our vaccine efforts at the health department. Vaccines are readily available in the community. Last we checked, you can get same week appointments at several pharmacies in the community, and many of our healthcare providers are also providing them. So our goal was to take care of the backlog, so folks weren't having to wait so long for an appointment and or leave the community. And I think to date we've achieved that, and we would encourage folks to reach out either to their healthcare provider or to their local pharmacy for vaccination.
Can you tell us if the if our constituents that are homebound, if they have had access?
Yeah, we've been running homebound clinics every Friday since the beginning of the year. We had wrapped up with everyone that had recently told us they needed it, and then we started calling everyone that got a homebound vaccine when we gave first and second doses. And so we're now working on getting to those folks as well. But we do have an ongoing program where each Friday we have a nurse that's going out and doing four, five, or six homebound individuals so we can work through those folks that need it.
That's great to hear. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Frank or Amy? I see none. Thank you very much for joining tonight. Lisa, do you have any other updates for us?
That's it for me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next is Bill Troy, county attorney.
Hello, everybody. One piece of news I can share with you is that our deputy county attorney is joining us next week. I'm looking forward to it. I have quite a bit of work to help her with. And do feel free to stop by. I think I've given you a little blurb about her background. I think she's going to be just a great fit for the county.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions for Bill Troy, county attorney? I see none. Thank you. Next is Director of Finance, Rick Snyder.
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to bring to you tonight our sales tax for the end of the year, the month of December, and the totals for the end of the year. And we also have a good report on our recent ban and bond sales. So I'll share my screen with you. I also sent this information out by email to you just moments ago around when the meeting started. So you'll have copies of all this on your computer as PDF files if you want to browse them later on or during the presentation. But I'll share my screen now so you can see what we're talking about for the December sales tax report. You can see, is everybody seeing the report?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. In the midsection here is where we show the county's portion of sales tax. And as you can see, for the month of December, we're up quite a bit from $3.6 million up to nearly $4.8 million just for the month of December. So that shows a 29.64% increase for the month of December. Over here in this right-hand portion, you can see that we're up about 21.43% year-to-date for the entire year, and that means that we came in total $41.6 million compared to last year at $34.3 million approximately. And so that's an increase year-over-year of $7,342,340. Again, 21.43% increase for the year. Down here you can see the comparison to budget. When we're looking at the gross budget for sales tax, we came in about $6,776,021 over budget for 2021, or 119.5% of our budget. So that was a good year, coming in way over budget. As always, we've graphed this out so everybody can see. The red line here at the top is where we have achieved one of our highest months. We're just about off the chart here at nearly $4.8 million for the month of December. The numbers at the bottom show comparisons to the two previous years. So you can see how we compared to 2020, and you can also see how we compared to 2019. So once again, far exceeding our budget for the year. I can also tell, if we look at this historically, I'm going to share another report that shows our, just looking at the fourth quarter, sales tax for the fourth quarter came in at 24.42% increase over the fourth quarter of last year, and that compares about $11.1 million compared to $8.9 million in the fourth quarter of 2020. And what I've also attached, and I always bring this to you in printed format, I'll straighten this out here in a second, we have a historical context to share that shows every year going all the way back to 1997. So if you want to look at your leisure at how we compare to previous years, we show the totals for about 11 years, the annual totals, and then we break it down into four different quarters. So you compare each quarter from 2009 right up to date. And if you compare it historically, these quarters here where you can see the total received with the city share, the town and villages share, and the county share all added together, the grand total of sales tax coming in was over $74 million in 2021. So I can easily say that this is not only the best December of record, but it's the best fourth quarter of record, and is also our best yearly record for sales tax. And I'll take questions on sales tax if anybody wants to ask anything on that. My next report will be on the sale of bonds that we recently had. Any questions on sales tax?
Thank you, Rick. We have Rich John.
Thank you, Rick, for your report. I'm just, if you could remind us, where does the line on the graph sit for 2022? What is our total that we're trying to budget for sales tax this year?
I don't have that piece in front of me right now.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I can. Having not done January's yet, how about if I give that to you at our next meeting? Because
That'd be fine.
Sales tax receipts just yesterday, and we haven't recorded them yet or distributed them. So we're aiming to give that information to you at our very next meeting. Would that work out okay?
Yeah, or I can just go look it up. It's fine. Yeah. Thanks, Rick.
Mike Lane.
Always glad to hear good news on the sales tax, because it's our source of income that's different from the real property tax, which is so burdensome to a lot of people. But let's always remember that sales tax is very regressive. It hits the lower income people harder than the upper income people, unlike income tax, for example. So we need to think about that it's sometimes the people on the bottom that are struggling to pay the sales tax.
Thank you, Mike. Randy Brown.
Thank you. Rick, you had sent to me before Ashley was on the legislature how sales tax is broken out in the extra 1% that is collected in the county. And I understood it, kind of, but it was very complicated. But if I look at it, it appears to me, and nothing gets my city friends, that the city is making out more money from the sales tax, that extra 1%, than the towns. And if you look at just pure population, it's obvious that's correct. Is that just a negotiation that happened in the city 20 years ago and we're stuck with it, or it just doesn't seem fair to me for my district?
Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, the city of Ithaca came in, if you look at either one of these reports, the December report, if you look at the year-to-date column, you can see that the city came in at about $15 million, $4.9 or $15 million. And the municipalities, towns, and villages came in at about $17.6 million. So the municipalities as a group make more than the city does. But you're right. The sales tax agreement goes way back many, many years. That was the distribution method that we use, which is pretty complicated, but you're right. If you look at the 3% portion compared to the 1% portion, et cetera, there are different sources that achieve our total 4% and how that's allocated. But that's something that no one's attempted to address or redo since, I believe, it's in the 90s.
Isn't that sales agreement have to be approved by the state each year? Isn't that?
Or is no.
The extra 1% doesn't have to be approved by the state somehow?
Well, the state has to approve, and they were trying to get legislation passed the last 3 or 4 years. I don't know how it was resolved last time so that we would not have to go back to the state. But we have to go and get permission to charge the entire 4%, which is a local portion, that has to be approved by the state legislature.
Yeah, I know, looking at the information you sent to me, a good portion of the extra funds that the city is getting is going towards youth programs in GIAC, which I completely agree with. It's just that I feel that my district's being shortchanged. So that's how I feel that.
Thank you, Randy. Deborah Dawson and then Mike Lane.
Yeah, further to this discussion, Rick, does the fact that the city seems to be getting the lion's share of the sales tax not reflect the fact that where the sales occur physically.
Right. There's two.
Who gets the money, and most of the stores are in the city.
Right. There's a major breakdown between what's collected inside the city and what's collected outside the city. For the 3% portion of the sales tax and for the 1%. And that is, you know, historically, that's been favoring the city for quite some time. But that's where a lot of population is, and that's where a lot of the commercial activity is. And after it's broken down into these two groups, 3%, 1%, and then two further groups inside the city and outside the city, it's then distributed by population. And I can always share that nice little flow chart that our predecessor, Kevin McGuire, helped me come up with that shows the flow of funds on how sales tax is allocated. We have a narrative that explains it, that's well written, and we also have a circular flow chart that shows the distribution. That's about the only way that you can explain it is to show it in a flow chart.
Yeah, I've got that chart, Rick. Really?
It's fun.
isn't that clear, but thanks.
And to bring to you the monthly allocations the way we do, I have to do 7 different spreadsheets to bring it to first, or 7 altogether. 6 spreadsheets have to be done first before you get this final spreadsheet, which is this simple report that I share with you each month. So there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes into breaking it down and proving it and auditing it and making sure the checks go out to all the municipalities, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you, Rick. I have Mike Lane and then Rich John.
To Randy's point, actually, even before I came on the legislature, and it was in the 90s, Rick, as you say, the extra 1% when the state said that counties could and cities could apply to the state for permission to add the 1%. Cities have the right to preempt for the sales in their city. And as I understand the negotiations back then, for the county to move ahead, they wanted an agreement with the city, and for the city not to preempt, they agreed that most of the 1% would go to the city. Frankly, as I was told, the towns and villages were sort of asleep at the switch and did not make a big issue of it back then. But the county did negotiate in return that some of that money would be used for projects that were important for people in the county, such as gadabout and other things like that. So it has a long history, Randy, but I don't think any of us have ever really wanted to reopen those negotiations.
Thank you, Mike. I was also just sent a message to remind members in the chambers to talk closer to their mics. The masks are making it difficult for our online viewers to hear us. Rich John?
I agree with some of the things Mike just said. For those who are watching at home, you can look at our budget, and section 2 of the adopted budget, page 13, has the graph, and we were just looking at it here. And Rick, I would compliment you and your colleagues for putting this together. It is actually a pretty good example, I think, of a graphic communication of information that works. I cannot imagine trying to do this in prose. It is a really, really complicated distribution of percentages of the sales tax received. And I think there's great room in looking at it to argue about, is it fair? And maybe so, but I would use the metaphor of the sweater that has the loose thread. If you start pulling at it, you can unravel the whole thing. This was a really complicated thing to put together, and we'd have to take great care in trying to open it up and redistribute. I think that would be a very, very difficult matter to undertake. Maybe do, but we just should go into it with a real understanding of how much work that would be. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Randy Brown?
The only thing I'd like to add after that is that the people in my district, they all come to Ithaca to do their shopping because there's no place to spend their money in those towns. So it doesn't, where it's spent doesn't matter because they don't have a choice. So.
Mike Lane?
But there is a point of delivery. For example, if you buy a car in the city of Ithaca and you live outside the city, the sales tax goes to not to the city because it goes to the point of delivery, which is your home. Same with major appliances and other things like that.
It's good to know. Thank you, Mike. Any other questions or comments? I see none. Thank you, Rick Snyder. We appreciate your help here.
I've got more for you.
Oh, Rick, you always have more.
Because the question came up, I don't often, or I don't know if I've ever shared this particular spreadsheet with you, but since the year is just over and we just finished it, this is a chart that shows the towns and villages down in the left hand, and the ones at the top are the ones that get tax credits, like Carolyn, Danby, Enfield, Broughton, Newfield, Dryden, instead of getting a check from the county. And then you can see the next group is ones that we pay cash. And this represents the whole year of payments to the municipalities. And if I go down the right-hand column here, you can see town of Ithaca got $3.9 million. Town of Groton got part of it as a check, around $500,000. And they also got $399,000 as a tax warrant credit. Town of Lansing got $1.8 million in 2021. Ulysses got $762,000. We have Village of Dryden got $464,000. Village of Freeville got $128,000. The Village of Groton got $581,000. Village of Lansing, $868,000. Village of Teaburg, $442,000. Village of Cayuga Heights, $917,000. So we keep this up to date every month. And, of course, the City of Ithaca's payments down here at the bottom, $2.1 million. And this all adds up to the money that runs through the county, through our distribution method, and back to the city, town, and villages. So once again, I don't know if I've ever shared this with the legislators, but the towns and villages call me quite a bit saying, how are we doing so far this year? What should we project for our budget next year? So I could always help them, consort with them a little bit as they put their budget caps on to help them refine their budgets for the next year. And we share these figures quite a bit with town supervisors, town clerks. I thought maybe you should at least see it so you can see that's one of the pieces you don't often get to look at.
Thank you, Rick. Any questions for Rick?
And then one more piece here. Here we're looking at the sale of the bands and the sale of the bonds that took place on February 2nd. We sold one series of bond anticipation notes. They amounted to $6,885,000, and they sold at the interest rate of 0.871%. So these bands, which are only 1 year long, were bought by Oppenheimer and Company with a maturity of 1 year. There were six bidders with competitive bids this time, and the documents were signed just 5 days ago on February 10th, and we get these note proceeds on Friday, February 17th. And then since I included this with your packet, you can see all the bands that were issued historically, and you can see how the rates, how the different rates applied over the years. But because interest rates have started to jack up recently, as you know, with inflation and with the 10-year treasury going up recently, that we kind of got hit with a higher rate than last time. But still, anything under 1% like this is really quite good. The purpose of the notes is defined here in this section, lifted right from the official statement of the bonds. I told you it was $6,885,000. That was broken down into three major projects, all bridge projects: the Etna Lane Bridge, the Cortlandt Street Bridge. I'm sorry, Central Chapel Road Bridge was paid down. We added one other new project this year for $4.9 million. So a major part of this one-year ban was for the Backup Emergency Dispatch Center. That's the one that we're doing in conjunction with Cornell. That's also the one that we were able to get tax exempt when at first they told us it might very well be a taxable bond or a taxable ban, but we were able to work that out so that this ban for $6.9 million, which included the dispatch center, was all non-taxable. Then the last piece here is the sale of the new money bonds. We recently had a Moody's rating review. I didn't share that entire report because I knew I would be bringing you this sale of bonds report soon. So we again achieved our AA1 stable rating, which was no change from the previous years. That's quite an exhaustive review that we go through. It takes about 6 weeks to gather all the data and go through the review questions with Moody's. And we sold two series of bonds, and the total of the two together was $18,195,000. The first bond was a $6.3 million public improvement bond, and that was bought by Roosevelt and Cross. We had four bidders on the sale, which was two less than last year's. The term of these bonds is 20 years, and the rate that we got was 2.4473. The second bond, the bigger one, is what we've been holding our breath for the last 3 years for the airport improvements. As you know, we've been floating interim notes or bands for the airport expansion project for probably 2 or 3 years, adding to it a little bit each time till we got up to $13 million in bands. Well, we retired those bands this month, and we came out with permanent financing for the airport. It's an $11.88 million bond. The interest rate is 2.97%. Also bought by Roosevelt and Cross. We only had three bidders on this sale, and that again was three less than last year's. The rate is a bit higher than most of our bonds because this is a longer term than most of our bonds. This one is for 25 years, and they last until 2047. Again, we signed these documents on February 10th. The delivery date of getting the money is this Friday or Thursday, February 17th. And for comparison, I shared all the bond issues, the two current ones right here at the top, between 2.5% and 3% for these last two bond issues. And then we shared all the rates that we paid for bonds and the terms of those bonds for the last 8 or 9 years. Anywhere from 1% all the way up to like 3.5%. The rest of this report shows the purpose of these bonds, which I've shared with you, some of the non-airport bonds was for facilities improvements, and that $6.3 million is affectionately known here for county legislators as our green initiatives or our green facilities improvements. Here, for purposes of the bonds, we just call them facility improvement, energy performance improvements. But that's how we're financing the first $6.3 million of the Green Facilities Initiative. And then, of course, the $11.9 million for the airport is detailed below. So this is all part of your packet, and I wanted you to be aware that the financing, which I have to work on for 6.5 months to get to this point to be able to refinance the bands and deliver a new bond issue. That's how long it takes. It's a big project and a big undertaking, and that's why we only do one big debt offering a year. So I'll take questions on bands and bonds if you have any.
Thank you, Rick. Any questions for Rick? Mike Lane?
No question, but thank you for all of that, Rick. That's and thank you for all the work that you and your department went into to get those bonds ready and keep our bond rating. And it means a lot to the people of Tompkins County to have low interest rates, and that means we don't have to raise our taxes as much.
Great point, Mike. Thank you. Okay, thanks for joining us, Rick. And
thank you for your attentiveness on a wonderfully exciting subject like this, but I'll keep you up to date on this big financing.
Sounds good. Thank you. Okay, we do not have any other county staff this evening that will come to us. Let's move on to our any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Dan Klein?
Yes, I would like to add a resolution urging the inclusion of $3 million in the fiscal year 2023 New York State budget to support 211 programs statewide. I so move.
Thank you, Dan. Seconded by Amanda Champion. Any discussion on that? See none. Let's do a roll call.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison? Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff, Mike Sigler,
yes.
Travis Brooks,
yes.
Randy Brown,
yes.
Amanda Champion,
yes.
Shauna Black,
yes.
We have 13 ayes.
Thank you. And let's move to the consent agenda. Resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. Advisory board appointments, ID 10662, the Historical Commission, Herb Alexander, member, and his term expires December 31st, 2024. Ethics Advisory Board, Sharon Solimowitz. I don't know if I said that.
Solimowitz, please.
Solimowitz. Yes, thank you, Rich. Member, term expires December 31st, 2024. Kathleen Katie Walpole, member, term expires December 31st, 2025. Public Information Advisory Board, Bruce Estes, member, term expires December 31st, 2024. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Veronica Pillar. Member term expires December 31st, 2024. Resolution A, adoption of list of designated officers and employees required to file an annual financial disclosure form, ID 10666. Resolution B, approval of appointment to the Tompkins County Council of Governments, TCOG, ID 10665. Resolution C, approval of 2022 succession of members of the county legislature to serve in the absence of the chair and the vice chair, ID 10664. If I can have a mover, please. Moved by Veronica, seconded by Amanda Champion. And let's do a roll call. Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Piller?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff? Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
We have 13 ayes, 0 noes. Thank you, Kathy. Let's move on to the standing and special committees. Let's start off with facilities and infrastructure. Chair Mike Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have not met since our last legislature meeting. We will meet again on Thursday, this coming Thursday, February 17th at 9 a.m. We will be talking about several different things, and particularly starting a discussion about downtown facilities and space use that we will be starting to examine. We'll be talking about the process for that. We aren't going to probably take any action on how we go forward, but we will be talking with our county administrator, and hopefully we'll be joined by you, our chair, and we'll be seeing where we can go with that. It's an important thing. We've spent some money on some capital project purchases, and we need to find out what space we need, what changes are going to be happening with remote working, for example, job sharing or other things that we have. And it'll be first time we've updated that in probably 7 or 8 years. Andy, anything else?
Thank you, Michael. Any questions for Mike Lane? I see none. Next is the crown jewel of committees, Government Operations Committee, Chair Amanda Champion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The crown jewel of committees met on February 3rd. We met on Zoom because it was a snowstorm day that day. We had numerous reports, which I would encourage folks to go back and watch. I'm not going to detail them all here. We heard from Ben Sandberg at the History Center. We heard from Jay Franklin about the 2022 AEM project and his year ahead. We also heard from Greg Potter at Information Technology Services. And just one note on that, he was talking to us, he and Lauren were talking to us about cybersecurity. And we should be getting, you know, and I haven't seen it in my email, and I need to follow up with Greg about there's sort of a primer that we all should read about cybersecurity, stuff that's related particularly to us. So let me follow up, and you should be getting something in your email. We had numerous resolutions, which we've done here tonight, and we'll do the green fleet policy. We talked a bit about our committee goals. Couple things. There's a small group still working on helping the clerks rethink and reform and restructure our advisory boards, and not the boards, but the process that the clerks need to go through to keep track of all the folks who go through all our, you know, up to 50 advisory boards. We also are, you know, going to need to be keeping up with our independent redistricting commission, which is meeting regularly, and at some point they'll be coming back to GEO to give us a report and a recommendation, which we will then share with the full legislature. Those are just a couple things on our yearly agenda. And then we had our usual reports, and that's about it. So I can have questions on that before we do this policy.
Any questions for Amanda? Dan?
Thank you. It's not a question. I just want to mention something that was came up in our meeting I think all legislators need to know about, is that Jay Franklin told us about the new assessments. There are about 20,000 properties reassessed in this county out of about 35,000, so more than half. And all those reassessments have now been posted on the county website. However, not everyone's going to receive their notification in the mail right away. If I understood correctly, he felt like that would just overwhelm the number of phone calls they would get the next day, and they wouldn't be able to respond to everybody. So if I understood correctly, the mail notification that everyone's going to get is going to be phased in over the next weeks or even maybe 2 months or something like that. I was lucky enough to get my reassessment in the mail already. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know that because you likely will hear from some constituents when that thing arrives in their mailbox. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Jay Franklin for sending those out 2 days before my vacation starts. Thank you. Randy Brown.
Yes, I know there's discussion about an assessment review board. How does that process work? Isn't there like a board in each town that at some point they can go to appeal? And how does that process?
Yeah. I'm not sure I can detail it perfectly because it's been suspended for the past couple of years because we didn't really feel that it was super useful. But I think we're restarting it this year, and probably we could talk after and check in with Jay. But each town has a small board, and the legislator is supposed to sit on that board, and it's an opportunity for people of that town or village to come in and, you know, explain why their assessment change is not appropriate. They have a chance to ask questions or talk to the folks there. And then that small committee then passes on a recommendation to the assessment. Yeah. So, but I'm sure Jay can talk about it more clearly at another point.
Any other questions for Amanda or comments?
I remembered one other thing I wanted to say. We also did talk about, which came up at our last legislature meeting, about making sure we had enough funding for our new colleagues, our newly elected legislators, to attend the NYSAC conference that's coming up, but also attend another conference that maybe would be above and beyond the $1,000 that were each allotted. And the committee agreed that we definitely wanted that to be possible for our new legislators. And Kathy suggested that we just reassess the funding situation when we normally do in July. And because some legislators don't use any funding, and we have this process now of reallocating funding to people who need a little bit more. So I think we're in agreement that is a priority. So our new legislators, you shouldn't feel confined that if you want to go to NYSAC, you should definitely go. And if there is another conference at some other point in the year, you should also be able to attend that. So
that's great. Thank you, Amanda.
Okay. And then I would move resolution to update the administrative policy manual policy 09-44, the Green Fleet.
Seconded by Greg Mezzi.
And I guess I'm not exactly sure what to say. Lisa and Terry Carroll is here if there are questions. We did have, you know, quite a bit of discussion. It's been updated significantly. And, hopefully we can move this forward.
Thank you. Any questions for Terry or Lisa or Amanda? Rich John?
I'd just like to hear just a little bit about it, a few sentences, if Terry or Lisa would be willing to share.
I would have Terry give an overview.
Yeah, I can give a quick overview. So, you know, the new policy is, like I think Amanda said, there's a bunch of changes from the previous policy. The previous policy wasn't necessarily working for everyone. It wasn't being followed through. So we were really trying to aim not only to hit the county's green goals, but also look at government efficiency. So, you know, some of the major changes that we're looking at in this policy is having someone act as a fleet manager and really being able to take a holistic view of the fleet and really see where there are opportunities for synergy, for combining buying power, for working, you know, between departments, sharing vehicles, and you know, basically following what's going on the vehicle front. So that's, you know, a major departure from the previous one. I think the other, you know, major thing is, you know, really an emphasis on electrifying vehicles when we can. We did provide a lot of, you know, outs. We definitely understand that not every vehicle is going to be electrified. We've had a lot of conversations in recent weeks with, you know, different departments and acknowledge that, you know, there's a lot of uses right now where electric vehicles just, they just don't cut it, unfortunately. But we're hopeful that in the next few years that'll change, and so we wanted to make sure that we're prioritizing that. The other pieces, you know, have to do with telematics, you know, being able to really make sure that we're tracking mileage, fuel usage, and then reporting that out to the legislature and to the committee and making sure that people have an understanding of what we're doing as we kind of progress with this green fleet. So I think those are the majority of the major changes.
Thank you, Terry. Any other questions? Ann Corman.
Thank you. I believe when I was sworn in again at the beginning of this year for this four-year term, I think it was still on my my job description that I need to comment whenever green vehicles are being brought up. But I stand to be corrected. I read the policy in detail, so thank you very much, Terry, and for others who might have contributed in that. It looks great to me. And especially adding in, you know, the part about the efficiency for the overall for the county. Like you said, do we need this many vehicles? Can we share? I just came back 2 days ago from a trip to Florida and took that in an electric vehicle. So for those people who are sometimes afraid of, you know, do they have range? Can you get from here to there? The infrastructure increases every time that I go out and take a long-term trip. So it's good to see. And I also saw more electric vehicles, which I hadn't seen before, driving down south. So it was great to see. So thank you for doing this policy.
Thank you, Ann. Amanda?
I just wanted to add something that came up in our conversation at GO. The fleet manager position is not going to be a new person that's hired. It's not a new job description that we're, you know, putting another position out there. It's it likely would be Terry, and but it's somebody who already works for us who can look at the bigger picture, and whoever the county administrator would designate.
Thank you, Amanda. Congratulations, Terry. Deb Dawson.
Yeah, well, Terry deserves congratulations on another front. For those of you who don't know, he's a new dad.
Yay, so Terry!
My question is, are you getting any sleep, Terry?
It's hit or miss. She had her 2-month shots today, so I hear her screaming downstairs. So
oh, no.
I'll see how tonight goes.
This will pass.
Okay. If there are no other questions, let's do a roll call vote.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Absolutely.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Piller?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff?
Yes.
Mike Sigler? Mike Sigler? Travis Brooks?
Yes, indeed.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. Anything else, Amanda?
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee, Ann Corman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let me get that window back open. We have not, our committee has not met since the last time that the legislature met, but we do have a meeting coming up on Monday, February 28th at 1:30. And some of the things that we're working on preparing are committee goals, liaison assignments, and also meeting with Greg Mezzi, the vice chair of the committee, and I are meeting with various departments that report to PDAC and organizations so that we can talk about how we can, you know, what their work plans are and what we can do to help support them coming up. So that's all I have for now on our for our agenda. There'll be more, but we're more than 10 days away right now.
Great. Thanks, Ann. Any questions or comments for Ann? I see none. Thank you.
Oh, Madam Chair, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
So this is something that's happening at the same time as our committee meeting on the 28th. The New York State is doing an overview of the flood maps, and there's the presentation that day at 1:00. I don't have the link for it, perhaps, I don't know if people have gotten the link for it, but I can make sure that everybody has the link in case they want to go to that. I know some of our planning department staff at least will be going to that.
Thank you, Anne. I know that there were many changes specifically in the city of Ithaca that city constituents are very, very concerned about. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, and I do hope that some of our legislators can attend that. Any questions for Ann? Okay. Next is Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met yesterday. The bulk of our discussion revolved around the work plans for the Department of Finance and HR, because we wanted to coordinate the committee's work with those departments for this year. We talked about goals, and I would prefer to think about focus more than goals, because goals hasn't worked out too well for me in the last couple of years. The things that we discussed and reached a consensus on were that we would complete the compensation study. We would examine our retention rate, consider ways to make ourselves a more desirable employer for the employees that we have. We would hire a permanent county administrator. We would improve the process for evaluating our direct reports. Move forward with the Community Recovery Fund. Evaluate and perhaps replace our rollover policy. And examine our base budgeting approach and figure out how to incorporate results-based accountability in the budget process in a more meaningful way. So that was the work of our committee. The other thing I wanted to remind you all about is that we are having a budget presentation, state budget presentation by NYSAC staff, Ryan Gregoire and Dave Lucas, tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. I hope that as many of you as possible will attend. This is a real privilege to hear from these guys on the state budget and how it might impact our county operations. And then in that vein, I sent you late this afternoon a document based on my review of the Senate staff's budget summary, executive budget summary. I tried to break down issues of interest by county committee. So if you don't have time to go through this whole thing, you can just look at the appropriations and Article 7 proposals that
relate to the committees you sit on. I hope that you'll have an opportunity to look at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. Any questions for Deb? I see none. Next is Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Granison, Chair.
Yes, the committee has not met since the last committee meeting. We are going to meet in about a week and a half. We're going to talk about the goals and other matters.
Thank you. Any questions for Henry? I don't see anything. Thank you, Henry.
Thanks.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Shauna. The Public Safety Committee will be meeting this Thursday, the 17th, at 3 o'clock. We will be getting a report from County Administration on the department goals, and we will also be considering committee goals and priorities. And there is a draft that is circulated, and hopefully everybody will come with lots of great ideas. The only other thing I'd report, as I do each meeting, is the jail population. The census reads 33 with 5 board outs. So we're maintaining our numbers pretty much where they've been. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Any questions for Rich John? Randy Brown?
I'd just like to comment. Last week we went and met the legislatures. They're new. Went and met with the sheriff and undersheriff and staff, and they were great. They spent a lot of time with us. I think we were there for well over 3 hours. We got, and they explained a lot. They talked to us about the numbers and the data they're collecting, which was very helpful, and then a tour of the facility. So just wanted to, they were very great.
It's really great to hear. Greg Muzzy?
Yeah, I would just sort of echo on to what Randy said. If you haven't been to that facility in a while, if you've had the opportunity to serve multiple terms on the legislature and haven't had a tour, Veronica and I were speaking afterwards, and it was really impactful, right? It was sort of a profound experience to see that, and just to kind of take it all in. And there's a lot I could go into, but I just would encourage all of us to really think about, as we get that, what those numbers mean that, you know, we get every legislature meeting. And I hope more people take the opportunity to take the sheriff and their team up on sort of that open door to tour the facilities at any time, because it might be a good reminder, you know, something we did as newly elected off, officials, but it's something that I think everybody should do more often.
Great point, Greg. And I think what is also very apparent is the need for a renovation of that jail space. I also encourage my colleagues. I did a ride along about 3 months ago, and it was very eye opening. One of the deputies took me on a Friday night. I worked the second shift, and we were covering Newfield, Trubensburg, and Danby. And that is a massive space for any one person to cover. And we were getting calls on every single point. And it was very eye-opening to see what our local sheriff's department, the work that they do. And it definitely gave me a newfound, not so much newfound, because I always appreciated the work, but it was very eye-opening. And I would encourage my colleagues to do a ride-along if you have an evening. Let's see here. Amanda and then Randy Brown.
Well, this is something I just remembered that is related but slightly different. I serve on the Tompkins County Public Library Board, and I think I sent you all an email, but just so the public knows, the library got a $10,000 grant to expand and build upon their literacy in the jail program. So they already had a small program that they were working with. They now have this, pretty sizable grant that they can extend their resources. They can have more people going into the jail to work with folks. they're talking about getting Chromebooks, I think, which will have like pre-installed books and magazines on there that the inmates can use. And it's a really great program, obviously helping educate folks and giving them something to do while they're there. So I'm really excited about that and glad that, you know, our library folks are working really hard to help others. So that's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. Randy Brown.
I forgot. Actually, the town of Newfield at their last meeting reached an agreement to put a satellite office there for the sheriff. And so I think that's moving forward, and they really appreciate it.
Oh, that's great
and
news.
It'll also save the sheriff from having to drive a long ways. He can go and do his reporting in those local towns, Enfield or Newfield. So.
Great. Rich John?
That is on the agenda this meeting to consider the satellite office, so that's a good thing. And I would just comment a little further on what you guys talked about, that our public safety building was commissioned, I think, in 1986, and we have gotten value out of it. You know, a public safety sheriff's office and a jail are 24/7. And sometimes the jail gets really hard use. We are due for some major decisions to be made about our jail. And our jail, I believe, is a bit different than a lot of jails. We, not surprisingly, have taken a position that our jail is not a warehouse. You do not just put people there. You bring them in and you try to figure out how did they get into our criminal justice system and is there programming that can help them get away from that and do better. I'm reminded of something Ray Bunce said to me at one of my visits to the jail, which was that just about everybody that comes into the jail leaves in better condition, that if they have a mental health issue that's untreated or a medical issue or a substance abuse issue, there are real efforts made to figure out how do we help that person. We also have a full-time person, Marie Boyer, who is our reentry coordinator, who meets with everybody there who is willing to meet and lines them up with available community programming to try to figure out, is there something we can do to address what led you into this situation? I think we can be very proud of the way our jail operates. We do it a very different way here, and it is in coordination with all our alternatives to incarceration. Obviously, we don't want to put people in jail. We're running remarkably low numbers, but those that end up there, we want to try to address them as well. So I'm glad you got a chance to see it. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Any other questions for Rich John? Okay, I see none. Next, Health and Human Services Committee, Dan Klein, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are going to meet tomorrow, Wednesday, February 16th at 3 o'clock. A number of, I would call them small items on the agenda, and then we'll be doing our goals. And Deborah, I like your word perspective, focus better. I'm going to try that one on because that feels better to me. So we'll be doing our goals and focuses. And also we'll be getting an update on the status of the merger of the public health and mental health departments. So if that's a subject that's interesting to you, feel free to tune in.
Thank you, Dan. Do you want to bring forth your member file?
Sure thing. Thank you. So our 211 program is a very valuable program. It's very easy and accessible to all people at all, on any given day. And during the pandemic, its usefulness became even greater. We have relied on them quite a bit to help disperse information that people wanted to know about the pandemic. So when I was asked to bring this resolution forward, I was happy to do so. So I would like to move resolution urging the inclusion of $3 million in the fiscal year 2023 New York State budget to support 211 programs statewide.
Moved by Dan Klein, seconded by Mike Lane.
The only other thing I would add is that the reason it didn't go through committee is the idea came through kind of late. And what this resolution is asking for is that funding for this program be included in the New York State budget. And it's our understanding that those conversations, even though the budget's still a couple of months away from being voted on, or weeks, I guess, these issues are being added to the mix right now. So that's why we wanted to give this little nudge to the state legislature.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions or comments for Dan? Randy Brown?
I have to say, we also went to and met with the Human Service Coalition, and they went over 2-1-1 with us quite a bit. We had a lot of questions, and it's a great service, and another thing we learned.
Yep. That's great.
I think we get a lot of value for it. It's a lot of there are staff, but there are also volunteers that run it, and so it magnifies our resource without a lot of money.
Yeah, it's been very helpful during the pandemic because, as legislators, while we think we know everything, we don't. And it's been nice to have a one-stop shop that we can refer our constituents to. And they do everything from helping people to get to vaccine sites to setting up vaccines for people. Like, it's really been invaluable. Okay, any other questions for Dan? Okay, I see none. Let's do a roll call.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman? Ann Corman?
Can you hear me say yes?
No. Yes. Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
We have 14 ayes, 0 noes.
Great. Thank you. Anything else for us tonight, Dan?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next, we have an individual member filed resolution. And Veronica, would you like to bring this forward?
Sure, yes. So I'd like to move the resolution titled Urging the New York State Legislature to Pass the Fair Pay for Home Care Act to Establish Fair Wages for Home Health Aides.
Great. If I could have a seconder, Rich John. And would you like to talk to this resolution?
Yeah. So the background on this is, home health aides, there's like a few hundred of them in our county, do a lot of work helping people in need of some sort of short or long-term care with due to like aging or disability or whatnot. And it could be help with household tasks. It could be help with, bathing, dressing, things like that. So they provide a super valuable resource, but there's a shortage of them right now that's only getting worse through the pandemic and stress in our healthcare systems. And so this means that a lot of people who, for lots of valid reasons, would rather stay in their home versus move to a nursing home or something, are going without care or with inconsistent care. And a major reason is that the wages for home health aides are shockingly low. It's like minimum wage is both typical and also that is the rate that Medicaid pays. So a lot of people who need this care are trying to hire their aides through Medicaid, and no one wants to be paid at like $13 an hour. So this bill would raise the minimum actual wage for the home health aides to 150% of minimum and allocate money into like health insurance reimbursement proportionally higher as well. It's also worth, while not everyone who needs home care is elderly, it's worth noting that our Office for the Aging has also signed on with, I want to say, about 40 other county offices of the aging statewide to support this same bill. The reason it's a member-filed resolution is similar to Dan's. Even though it is a bill, it is requiring like a large money allocation in the budget, and so if that could pass soon enough, given where they are in the budget process, these wage increases could happen next year as opposed to waiting for the subsequent one.
Thank you, Veronica, and thank you for bringing this forward. I have actually looked at both the assembly and the companion bill, and having worked in healthcare, the people that serve as our healthcare workers, that is definitely one of the hardest jobs, emotionally, physically, mentally. And you're exactly right. Whenever I worked in healthcare, we had aides that were making $9.50 an hour. And we're working two and three jobs, just to have, ends meet. So I really thank you for taking the time in writing this, and, I will certainly be supporting it. Let's, see Deborah Dawson and Ann Corman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Veronica. Congratulations on drafting your first resolution. I will be supporting this as well. It's disappointing to me that with the emphasis that Governor Hochul put on building up our medical staff and medical professions in New York State and all the money she allotted to that effort, that she left these very important home health care people out of the equation. So I certainly support this and hope that the legislature will correct her oversight.
Thank you, Deborah. Ann Corman.
Thank you. I will, of course, also be supporting this. And just to one thing that Veronica said about various people or situations you might find yourself in, you know, needing assistance at home. I was in my early 30s. I was in a car accident. I was homebound with injuries, and I couldn't even walk to the kitchen. I could barely get to the bathroom. Couldn't do medication, management, food, anything. So thank goodness I was able to get some assistance at home. I'm not sure what I would have done if I couldn't. So these people do such an invaluable job. It's very difficult. It's really important. And, you know, other countries, they pay people, you know, they value this type of job a lot more. And I'm glad to see that, you know, we're going to be pushing for this. So thank you for bringing this forward. It needs to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Any other questions or comments? Lee Shurtleff?
Well, let me start by commending Veronica for raising our consciousness on the issue. It's indicative of the broader challenges with health care and the provision of that. I can think, too, to the certified nursing assistants that are in many of the institutional facilities that are kind of in the same boat. And personally, I've had to engage home health care aides in family situations. So I share your concern and hope that there can be some changes in how that works. My only concern is that there's further implications to such legislation as this. And it really relates back to my concerns in how funding occurs and what happens in Medicare, private insurance, self-pay. I've got a lot of constituents that are attempting to engage home health care aides. And because of the limitations or almost non-existence of Medicare support for home health care, that's a problem. And with private insurers, that's a problem. It's all over the map on what you may or may not get. So this resolution predominantly will relate back to Medicaid and what the state and federal government are willing to provide. My hesitancy here goes a little bit further. I spoke earlier about the case with bail reform or the issue, and there is accompanying state legislation, Senate Bill 8181, that was introduced, and my inclination was to come charging in here and look for a vote of support, but I had to think about that a little bit in the context of over 15,000 individual bills being introduced in this session of the state legislature. I think the last count was 14,000 in the Assembly and 16,000 in the Senate. It's hard for me to look at each one of those and then consider bringing them forward. So philosophically, I can't support these types of resolutions. I supported what Dan set forth, I think, because of it expresses a sentiment and relates directly to a service that Tompkins County is employing through this pandemic and the need. Not that this is not just as important. The other part to that is that, you know, it wasn't too many years ago that Tompkins County provided home health care through the health department. Maybe there's a chance someday that we'll be back into that, or that need may occur. And I could hear some of our colleagues now questioning an unfunded or underfunded mandate if we were in support of this. So that's my problem with it. But I do appreciate that the issue has been brought forward, and I do hope that there continues to be discussion in many of the employment arenas with our healthcare workers, because it is definitely a problem. And furthermore, you can see that just in recent weeks with the delaying of the mandatory staffing levels in healthcare facilities. There just aren't the people there to fill the positions, despite the best intentions of that legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Great points. Any other questions or comments? Veronica?
Hey, thank you, Lee. If I could just respond to part of that. One, I totally agree that we can't be here, like, passing resolutions about all the bills at the state legislature, because that's not what we're here for. This one came out of, actually, like, conversation with Dan about the Health and Human Services Committee, thinking about what our focuses could be and knowing that home health aides are, you know, like, this is a crisis in our county and wondering what can we do about it. And this is, like, you know, not directly addressing that, but it's something. So it came out of concern for an issue in the county. And then in this process, I know both of us have talked to Lisa Monroe from the Office for the Aging, so you might be happy to know that they are going to hire, or trying to hire, two part-time home health aides to work directly for the county. So that's, you know, that's two. They could care for a few people, but that's something that they're coming back to.
Thank you.
Randy Brown.
Thank you. I support this because it affects people who need help the most. And it really, long-term, saves money. If people can stay in their homes, like my mother, who's 89, she wouldn't be home if we didn't have somebody to come to help her take a shower and those kinds of things, because she can't do it. And it'd be a lot more expensive if she was in a home somewhere. A lot more expensive than somebody coming once or twice a week. So, just wanted to share.
Any other questions or comments? I just want to add a short comment. Thank you all so much. Like, we were able to have an amazing debate here. Everyone was respectful. It can be a very emotional topic that we're talking about, but this is the way that it should be done always. And I'm very proud of everyone. So, thank you. Let's do a roll call.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison? Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Pillar?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff?
No.
Mike Sigler?
No.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
We have 12 ayes, 2 noes.
Thank you very much. Next, let's go to the minutes of the previous meeting. If I could have a mover for the minutes for February 1st, 2022. Moved by Veronica Piller. If I could have a seconder. Seconded by Lee Shurtleff. Any questions, comments, concerns, changes? I see none. Let's do a roll call.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Down?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Piller?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. And what I would like to do next is, why don't we plan on going on a break, and then we will go to executive session. Let's go ahead and vote on executive session. For the purposes of litigation, real estate negotiations, contract negotiations, personnel matter about a particular person, and we do not intend to take action after the meeting, after the executive session. If I could have a mover for executive session, moved by Randy Brown, seconded by Veronica Piller, and we'll do a roll call.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Greg Mezzi?
Yes.
Veronica Piller?
Yes.
Lee Shurtleff?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Done.
Travis Brooks?
Yes.
Randy Brown?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. And executive...
Could I ask a question? Should I stay for this?
No.
I'm supposed to stay for any of these?
No, you are fine to leave. Thank you, Rick. Mike Lane?
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to point out that I...
Good night, Rick.
I'm going to be recusing myself from the first part of the executive session having to do with litigation.
Thank you, Mike. That will be noted in our minutes. And why don't we plan on reconvening at 7:35? Thank you all.
Recording.